Hi, this is Jeff Siegel, the wine curmudgeon, and my guest today is one of the blog's pals, our unofficial butcher, and shout out to my brother in southern Wisconsin, my brother's official butcher, Nick Vorpagel, the vice president of Lake Geneva Country Meats, which, despite its name, has a fine, wonderful, terrific wine department. Nick, thank you so much for doing this.
I am glad to be here, Jeff. Thank you very much. Appreciate the introduction. Always good to be on with you.
Well, thank you. You should tell people now very briefly, because, you know, with this Substack thing, I got all sorts of new people who have not heard you before. Why does Lake Geneva Country Meats have such a terrific wine department?
Well, short story is I like to drink. Long story is, so we're a butcher shop, retail butcher shop, and we sell a lot of steaks. We sell a lot of brats. We sell a lot of different things. And what goes great with steak? Wine. As we've added, we've been in business for 56 years, and we've added. One of the things we said was, you know, where we could get a little extra money and have a little wine around the house for ourselves, add wine. So we did that about 15 years ago. I've been running the department for 12, I believe. I did the math recently. And so we try to focus on wines of place, wines of quality. You're not going to find Mark West Pinot Noir in the shop. You know, there's a place for that, I suppose. But you're going to find wines that I think are, first of all, food friendly. There are a few things that aren't necessarily food friendly, but I want to focus on stuff that goes great with food. I want to go with family producers as much as possible. And then I want stuff that's a good value. You know, we all could go out and spend $200 on some cult cab from Napa, and I'm sure it's good. But, you know, what's the fun in that? If we can go find some little field blend from, you know, Contra Costa County in California, it's a lot more fun.
It is a lot more fun. And that's one reason why, you know, you've been a pal of the blog for so long and why I like to have you on the podcast is because we agree on this. The idea that the wine, A, should be fun and B, it shouldn't cost as much as 14 pounds of prime rib.
That'll get you about a bottle of Opus, I think.
So we'll skip the butcher part, as much as you and I were chatting about that before we started recording. We'll skip the butcher part because I know that that'll bore most people. But let's very briefly talk about supply chain problems, which seem for some people, some retailers to be getting better, some retailers to be getting not. Where are you guys in this?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's been, I'll call it a rolling supply chain issue. You know, we have rolling blackouts and we now kind of have some rolling supply chain issues. You can always count on something's going to be short and it's going to be short for a while and you're going to have to adapt. You just don't know what it is. So this spring, shipping from Australia, New Zealand over to the West Coast has been tight. So a lot of the New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs that are very popular in the summer, obviously, Australian Reds, things like that, have been short coming over. People have gotten smart. The stuff coming from Europe has been really a challenge with all of the different COVID lockdowns there. Customs have been a battle for many years, understaffed, taking too long with the government type of stuff, and COVID's just accentuated that. So people are shifting how they ship to do bigger loads, consolidating, moving things to smaller ports on the East Coast. So right now, it looks like some of the stuff, I'm waiting on a load of various Rhone wines and some Sancerre because we can't sell enough Sancerre these days, which kind of happened when the New Zealand stuff was out, shift to France, then that runs out. So we're hoping September we should start seeing stuff from Europe again. In the meantime, we're just kind of picking through inventories and what we can get.
So the distributors and wholesalers, have they ordered a little bit more to make up for this? Are they keeping more in inventory?
Yeah. And that's one of the things that causes some of those issues sometimes is you have a big retailer or a big wholesaler say, you know what, I have enough cash. I'm going to get in front of this. We're just going to say Kim Crawford as an example, because, you know, huge brand, whether you like it or not, you know it, and you'd probably drink it if it was put in front of you. So you don't want to run out Kim Crawford. Like, that's just a dumb wine to run out of. So they'll go and buy just an insane amount of it. And then that causes issues for the person that didn't do it. I know one of my bigger distributors sells a very large Chilean wine brand, and they have been begging to buy containers full because they don't want to run out for Christmas. And they're not the only people that are having this. It's kind of like the thing of, if you think traffic, you know, you drive to your grandma's house on the morning of Thanksgiving, it's kind of busy. So next year I'm going to drive in the afternoon while everybody else had that idea. So it's that groupthink is kind of driving some of these supply chain issues.
So what you're telling us, Nick, is that retailers and wholesalers are worrying about Christmas now.
Yeah.
And we're recording this at the end of June, which is typically 2 or 3 months before you start worrying about Christmas, huh?
Yeah. So I believe it's something like 80%, 70 to 80% of wine is sold in October, November, December. In the industry, we call it OND. And that's when deals come on. That's when everybody gets really aggressive and kind of a little bit of inside baseball there. But that's when you really are looking to, okay, how can I make money? How can I stock the store? What can I do? Those deals we've all been told, because you kind of plan your purchasing and your programming around that. We've been told those aren't going to happen this year just because labor cost up, freight cost up, savings that could be passed along aren't going to be there. And the choices, market up to market down or don't plan on it. So we've been told don't plan on it. We all remember last year, champagne in particular was impossible to get. So people are starting to stockpile. I've grabbed a couple cases of champagne that I want to have for New Year's already because I know I'll sell it. I have a little bit of cash sitting around. The other thing is people are taking more margin, at least around here. I am taking more margin because I'm not getting as many deals and I know I'm going to have to sit on stuff. So I'm taking a little bit more margin. And I think that's where some of the, I'm sure we'll talk about pricing at some point, but I do think that's where some of the inflation that customers are seeing is coming in.
You know, it's interesting, and I've had this discussion about pricing with any number of people. And from California in particular, there are still oceans and oceans and oceans of bottles of wine sitting in warehouses.
Yeah.
And yet wine prices and demand, wine demand has gone down, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And we're not seeing any deals on pricing. And I understand what you're saying is because the supply is short at this moment, but it's one of those fascinating economic concepts. It seems to break every law of economics that there is. Yeah.
And one of the things that people are really concerned about is, and people are planning for, is we're looking at a couple vintages out of California, especially on the higher end wine, that 2020, many wineries in Napa didn't make a vintage. So you're looking to, and this is more on the higher end, but people like me, all right, we sell a ton of Duckhorn Cabernet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm going to grab a couple extra cases of that, even if I know it won't sell. And so the winery's saying straight up, we're not going to drop the price. You know, we're going to raise the price because it's, you know, we still need to make however many dollars we need to make to keep the lights on. We still have to pay everybody. And it's not just on the high end. It's, Central Valley was affected by it too. And one of the things I'm telling people to really look out for is look out for new wine brands that are a 2020 Napa Valley wine that seem too good to be true and too cheap to be priced. Because there's a lot of smoke tainted fruit out there that is getting sold off as bulk juice. And someone will buy it at a cheap enough price and put it out. And you might say, holy cow, a $15 Napa Cabernet. If it says 2020 on it, something you don't have a track record with, that's a red flag.
Yeah, no, I've heard that as well too. Thank you for mentioning that, because that's exactly the kind of thing that my readers, I mean, they'll scoop that up. Oh my God, that's a $45 wine for $15, and there's the reason. So let's talk about the values that you may or may not still be able to find out there. What have you been seeing? And Nick, let me throw my disclaimer in here. Nick is in Wisconsin. So prices and availability may differ where you are, because prices, we're stuck with the three-tier system and all of its evilness.
They're going to vary. I was talking to one of my friends yesterday about just how it takes to get stuff here imported, and that's more like a seven-tier system. So, it's really hard to say where there's value these days. And you used to be able to say, you know, hey, kind of look at Australia. You know, those wines are a little underpriced. Or, you know, South Africa, you can find pretty good consistent values. Or take a look at South America. And I think, unfortunately, it's hard to make a blanket statement of a region or anything like that right now to say, you know, anything you buy from here is going to be good. I think the internet has kind of leveled prices a little bit and corrected some of those things where there's no real undiscovered regions right now. There's some stuff coming out of Eastern Europe that is cheap and interesting, but I don't know how good it is. It's worth a try, and maybe you can hit a brand that you like. I would say South Africa is still putting out wines of some significant quality. that are at really great prices compared to things you're going to find from elsewhere in the world. I think, unfortunately, South America is getting priced correctly. But to say that it's a great value across the board, it's tough. But Spain, to me, Spain and Portugal are still kind of the undisputed champions of where you can find great value. You can find some lovely Vino Verdes out of Portugal in that $10 to $12 retail price point still. That, you know, I think that's the new $8 to $10 price point, unfortunately. You know, unfortunately for the $10 Wine Hall of Fame. But you can find some really lovely crisp whites out of Portugal. Some of the reds they're doing, field blend type things, are interesting, great with grilled foods, especially in the summer, and priced really well. Spain, if you love sparkling wine, I'm on record as I generally hate cava. Hate it. Can't stand it. Tastes dirty. Doesn't use real grapes. But they have cleaned up production a lot there. Segura Viudas is still, you know, 10 bucks or under. And it's just a great value. But there's some stuff in the $15 to $16 range for cava that is just incredible quality. And their reds are always great as well. So Spain, Portugal, South Africa, that's kind of where I'm looking right now as a general rule of thumb.
And it's funny because the pandemic forced me to look elsewhere than where I typically look for wines for the blog. And I was stunned at how much quality has improved in South Africa. And the other thing that stunned me, and I have no idea whether this is a problem with retailers, a problem with the Portuguese wine establishment. But I mean, when you look at the prices, Portuguese reds in particular, compared to France and compared to California, and you're getting as much quality at a third to a half of the price. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
I think you have a good point there where I think the retailers have a tough time with it. I have a deep love of Portuguese. My sets, you know, we have 300 different bottles, something like that. So it's big enough that I can do some volume and get a variety, but small enough that I can pick some favorites. And I redid it to feature Portugal. Most people are going to have it kind of as an afterthought with Spain or with the port wines. And somebody that's buying port wine, a sweet dessert wine, isn't going to be looking for a dry red. And if you look at Spanish wine, you're going to see Garnacha, Tempranillo, Rioja, words you know. And you're going to see Castelao, you know, Tintorori, you know, all these weird Portuguese things that you're like, I don't know about this. So I think the Wines of Portugal is doing a good job with education. I think they're working on some of the laws. There's a new generation of producers there that get, hey, if we want to hit the export market where the money is, we need to work on how we label stuff. So I think it's the old thing of consumers don't want to try what they don't know, and retailers don't exactly know where to put it. It's always a battle, always a battle.
You actually mentioned one of the blog's longtime favorites that has fallen in disrepute, the Segura Viudas, which the company was sold a while back, and I'd noticed a discernible drop in quality on that cava. And took it out of the Hall of Fame. Has it gotten better or should I try it again?
I'd say try it again because you're right. It sold and it got worse. 100% it got worse. They, I think, saw some fall off in the market and fixed it a little bit. It's not as good as it used to be. But I think in terms of a $10 wine that you can find everywhere, it's still, you know, about as good as it can get.
Okay. And you'd mentioned some cava at 15, 16 bucks, a couple of names that you would recommend.
Yeah. So I got to talk about this winery that my friend imports. You're one of the champions of talking about look at the importer, find importers that you trust, and you really can go with that if you see that on the back. And one of them is called Vintage 59. They have some really great ones.
One of
the
ones,
and one of the ones that my friend brings in, it's called Sumaroca. They have everything from just a Brut to some extra reserves that are underpriced. We're selling a reserve level cava right now from Sumaroca, Sumaroca. That's, I think, $16 retail. It's vintage wine. It is beautiful. It's incredible. It's everything you like about sparkling wine. Tastes like Spanish wine, so it's got a little bit more of that kind of earthiness than what you'd expect out of French sparkling wine, but great quality, really clean bubbles. I love that one a lot. There's a couple other, but that's the one that really has been sticking out to me, and we've been enjoying both at home and in the store right now.
So you just, what it comes down to, Nick, is you just don't want to have to pronounce Zorello. That's what it is. Like one of the white Spanish
No. I mean, I have a tough time with that one. So yes, if we can avoid that, that is a positive. The other one I should throw out too is Reventos y Blanc. They traditional producer. They changed the cava law, so they're out a little bit, but they're doing a lot with Jose Andres. Mm-hmm. Right now, and they've done some really cool special stuff with all of the fundraising he's doing through World Central Kitchen. So that's another one, Reventos y Blanc, that if you see any of their wines, they're
the Reventos, the Reventos.
Yeah, they're on that really $15 nice retail, and yeah. they're great wines. I hate saying $15 is kind of where good value starts, because it's, I'm 35. And I can remember when $15 was a premium bottle of wine. But if you're looking for wine, I think of that shows quality, place, and is made by real people, that $15 is kind of a good place to be right now.
No, that's actually one. I agree with you completely. And you imagine the $15 to me, what that means. That's what happened with Cava. And again, I just say two things. I was joking. Zorello is one of the grapes mm-hmm. that's used to make cava. And Nick had mentioned that he doesn't think they're real grapes, which is why I was teasing him about it. The other thing, because obviously Champagne is made with Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, which are, of course, real grapes.
They are real grapes.
I just make quote marks with my fingers. The other thing is that about cava, and it's been one of the great disappointments for the blog, is that most of the big producers that had made terrific $8, $10, $12 cava over the last 5, 6, 7 years were all sold. And there seemed to be a fallout in which after the sales, the bigger brands used less quality grapes, didn't cut the price, just made crappier wine. And so that left a space open for the Reventos. There's a couple of others. Where they can get away charging $15, and the wine's worth $15. I'm not complaining about that, but that's kind of the reason. Yeah, okay. So sure. now we've had wine economics talk. So that's pretty good.
Well, isn't that why people subscribe to the blog? They like wine and they like economics.
You're right. If they want a toasty enoki, there's 73 gazillion others out there.
There is toast. There is literally toast, So if you want that, you can, made by the same company that brings you butter Chardonnay,
that's and right.
Cabernet
butter.
Sauvignon, you can get toast.
Butter Chardonnay, one of the, in fact, it's not worth making that joke. Well, listen, this is, you've told us almost everything that I wanted to hear, that other than how horrible the supply chain is, which I was hoping was, I'm talking to people, I still see the problem, but who knows, maybe it'll get better. But the other thing I want to ask you, typically, and I know your customers are a lot of retired, a little better off than many other. Are they looking for anything in particular, or are they being as adventurous as younger wine drinkers?
That's a great question. I think for us, 35% of what we sell is Cabernet. It's always going to be Cabernet. As much as I try to tell people, hey, there's other things that go with steak on the grill. It's just so drilled into the American experience that if you get a great steak and you have a glass of Cabernet. So the old standbys are still the old standbys. Where I have seen more adventure, and I think we talked about this earlier this year, is sparkling wine. There's so much more sparkling wine being consumed. And that isn't just younger people, that's older people as well. And they aren't necessarily reaching for the bottle of champagne, which my beloved Paul Roger recently took a price increase as well. I used to call that, the best value in champagne at $50. And now it's like 60, which is just, oof.
Welcome to the club, buddy.
Killing me. But they're buying things that are from different appellations. The more premium cavas, which again is $15. American sparkling wine, I think, is having a bit of a moment. We're doing well with some sparkling wine from South America, that they are starting to do well. I think they had a challenge because it's all Chardonnay based from Argentina. And I think that there was a challenge trying to get the right amount of acidity into those grapes. They've figured that out. So people are really getting adventurous in sparkling wine. I wish I could tell you the Central Rhone or Central Coast Rhone blends that we've tried and foisted on people have gone really well. They haven't. And it's what's really doing well and people are really enjoying right now is, I think, kind of takeaway from the type of Pinot Noir that was big, juicy, jammy, Paso Robles, red blends, and Cabernet. Dow, we can't keep it in stock. We're just selling tons of it. We are selling a ton of that stuff. And that's where people are getting interested is some of the Appalachians in California that are making good Cabernet at reasonable prices.
No, it's I've been waiting for 5 or 6 or 8 years now for Napa and to a lesser extent Sonoma to price itself out of the everyday retail market. And I think we're getting very close to that.
We are there. I think the last bottles that I have that I feel are reasonable, I don't want to call them every day, but you can have them once a week if you want, are Truchard. Mm-hmm. Which is family owned. They own the land forever. So it's $25 more or less on the shelf. Bueller, where he is just old school as can be, long-term contracts, has a lot of land, $25. And then Black Stallion, which is kind of the luxury brand of a very large company, was $25. Well, Black Stallion just took a price increase to $30. That's a different price point.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to start seeing kind of across the board, your get in for Napa Cabernet is going to be $30-$35. And that just takes it out of what people are willing to
pay. I mean, that's 90% of the US, 90-95% of the US retail market is never going to pay that much.
Yeah, never. So it's horrible. In other spirits news, we actually just got a store pick barrel of 1792 bourbon. And I priced it aggressively. I priced it at $45, selling for $60 most places. And people asked me, why did you price it this low? This is great. And I said, well, because I know what's happening in the bourbon market where people are just reselling and chasing stuff. And when I was a kid, I remember, you know, and it's getting to the point you can't afford bourbon. When I was a kid, I could buy Napa Valley Cabernet for $15. I could buy champagne for $35. Now, it was a lot of money, but I got to try the best things in the world. And so if I can price this bourbon where somebody 25 can come in and say, I like bourbon, I don't get to try the top end of Kentucky, but I can afford this. That's important to me. And I'm very sad that Napa doesn't have that anymore, that somebody that's 25 getting into wine wants to understand what Napa Cabernet is about, can't afford it. I hate that.
All right, you and me both. So that's all right, but enough with negative. Wine curmudgeon.
Not negative.
The wine curmudgeon will try to end our little talk here on less negative news. So 4th of July, I'm probably going to run this after the 4th of July, so I won't ask you for a wine and food pairing for the 4th of July.
So
no, I won't ask you for that because it'll run after the 4th of July. But I will say that if you, you mentioned Vino Verde. So tell me a couple of the brands that you like, and because I'm a huge Vino fan. So
I am a big fan of J. Portugal Ramos. It's okay. They have some single varietal specific, grape varietal specific Vino Verdes. The one I really like is their Luero. It's delicious. They have a couple other ones. I would just say anything they do, it's going to be under $12, whether it's red or white. It is going to be yummy. It's going to be delicious. I think we sold something like 25 cases of it last year. So for us, that's a really great volume. And I would steer people that way. Do you want to hear what I'm making tonight?
Well, no, actually, Zoom is telling me that we have to end, which I don't know why.
No.
But
9:41.
So, go figure. Anyway, so I'll just do this. I'll say, Nick, Morpeko, Lake Geneva Country Meats, thank you for doing this. It's always a pleasure.
Good to see you, Jeff. Have a good one.
Take care. This is Jeff Siegel, the Wine Curmudgeon. So long until next time.